previously on seasons 2 and 3 of the Baker's Dozen podcast.
Guys, can we step it up a little bit? I mean, come on, this happens every week!
Chachi V is in the studio. Chachi, what's up, my man?
Oh, not much. Rough Sunday.
Oh my gosh, I know what you mean, man. If only our listeners knew the things that we did on the weekend, they wouldn't want to listen to us.
The only way I'm going to watch the next season is if they get Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly
yes!
to do the season, because at least I can laugh at some terrible acting.
Definitely could have thrown a couple base hits in there, but, you know, I'm a home run hitter, Clement. Either the ball goes over the fence or it's going to be caught on the warning track. There's no base hits for me. We're going for the whiskey.
As for yours truly, well, humble, that's where I'm going to go. Because I won.
So you can put, you know, me in the cage with Brock Lesnar and people are going to watch it because they want to see Brock Lesnar, you know, destroy somebody.
Is that you challenging Brock Lesnar? Would you fight him for the payday?
You know, all the way I'll challenge Brock Lesnar if he had both hands tied behind his back and I got to use a baseball bat. That's about the only way that fight's ever going to happen.
I still think the odds are going to be pretty tough for you in that one. No offense to you.
What one word best describes what it's like for you to be a Cleveland Browns fan?
Purgatory.
Well, if we look at the rest of your picks, your second round pick, 7th overall, was the Masters champion. Now, Tim Krumrein likened that to MC missed cut.
That's correct. He did give it the MC, and I had to tell him what that really meant. That's the Masters champ, man, the defending Masters champ. He's rock solid.
I've played the backup quarterback, man. I played the starting quarterback. You know, I've played both sides. It's hard to have a backup come in and produce on a whim, you know, and because, you know, they're playing as if their job's to lose. You want someone to play when they're comfortable because you play better when you're comfortable. If you always think you and you're going to mess up, your job is done. You can't perform one of those situations. So I think guarantee the man his spot, being Kirk Cousins. Give him a spot, man. Give him 7-8 games, you know, and just say, you're our guy. To have a coach tell you you're our guy means a world to a quarterback. I mean, it's the hardest position in football.
The show has finally caught up and even passed the books. Damn you, George R.R. Martin. Damn you. Seriously, dude, you suck right now. I mean, thanks for the source material, but seriously, paint dries faster than you write.
Well, I don't think running backs should be penalized because of the failures of teams in the past to adequately assess the talent of the guys that they're drafting.
When I take home this title, which I will, I think you know, in past drafts, we haven't done the snake draft. I think that's going to be nothing but beneficial for me and in my wisdom. You know, good luck, guys. You know, enjoy watching me drink this shot. I'll cheers to each one of you as it simmers down into the bottom of my belly.
I want to say Cleveland, but after watching the 30 for 30, it made me depressed. It was I really want Believeland to get one because it was depressing. But it's just so much harder in Cleveland than sports. It just is.
Thank you for having me down here and to our kitchen table. I mean, I really went out of my way to
insider,
make it here.
That's insider information. The studio is our kitchen table.
Oh, no, I gave it away the secrets.
Never needed to call 911 when order a tuna sub. I'm just saying, folks. I remain a giant and you Jeremy Shock. And if you ain't heard me properly, if you speak garbage, then we know copies. DC chilling. Floor to the ceiling, stunting in my billionaire. Gear on my billionaire friends, that's money on my mind. Wale. It's nearly impossible for me to believe that I've recorded over 60 total episodes here at the Baker's Dozen podcast. 13 episodes for season 1, 3 for season 2. Another 13, counting this one for season 3, have me nearing 40 weekly episodes, alongside various special edition, quick hit, money problems, and rise to the challenge episodes. I have to admit it's been quite a ride since we kicked things off all the way back on March 10th of 2015. Almost 16 plus months later, and we're going stronger than we ever had believed we could have. My name is River City Clement, and I am your creator, executive producer, and host here at the Baker's Dozen podcast. But as I reflect on a shortened season 2 and a resurgent third season, I don't care about any titles I have. the hours I've logged, or the dozen of gigabytes of data on my laptop from creating this show. Instead, I want to reflect on the tremendous guests I've had these past two seasons, all the laughs, and the incredible support I've received from none more than my incredible fiance, Heather. So to close out this third season, I want to look back at the past 16 episodes from season 2 and 3 combined and bring you some of my favorite moments from the show, the moments that really stick out to me, whether I recorded them yesterday or 7 or 8 months ago. You heard several of these moments during the intro, during our infamous Previously On segment. But for more in-depth interviews, stories, predictions, reviews, contests, suggestions, and interactions with the guests, the heart of every episode of this show, I hope you keep listening to this show. I hope you enjoy some of these clips this episode as much as I did on their second, third, or even 10th listen. These clips help symbolize what's best about this show, spending time with friends and family who share a common interest with me. Whether it's sports, pop culture, or politics, I'll go toe-to-toe with any podcast, radio show, or sports personality when it comes to bringing on guests who are both knowledgeable and personable. People who care, people who have invested opinions, and people who just like to have fun and interact and help me out. They're only on here because they're my friend, they're my family, and they want to talk. And that means the world to me. This may be a small local podcast based out of Richmond, Virginia, but it doesn't mean that we don't do our very best here to bring you the most varied and unique perspectives, whether it's sports, pop culture, politics, or a mashup. And with that, let's roll some clips and enjoy the very best of the Baker's Dozen podcast, seasons 2 and 3. Enjoy.
You know what, man? I said it at the end of pretty much every time I was on last year, but it truly is my pleasure. I'm looking forward to seeing where this podcast go, man. It's got tons of potential. You as a host, you do a great job, you know, laying out the format for everybody to be on here. It really is interesting to listen to. You give great insight into everything. The guests are awesome. The topics are great. Sports, pop culture, things like that. I'm just lucky to be a part of it, man, and you know, really excited and happy to be hitting leadoff.
You know, you remember when Straight Outta Compton hit, you know, you're a fan of all sorts of music. What was it like on the music scene when you had the segue from, you know, more of the Sugar Hill Gang, more of the Public Enemy, to the West Coast gangster rap that NWA brought? What was that like being a fan of music at that time? Because I know you were listening to this album when it came out.
I mean, obviously, it was just, you know, just a huge, huge change in things that had come before. I remember specifically, you know, NWA and even Two Live Crew. And, you know, I'm sure probably at that age, you know, for us little middle America white kids, a lot of it had to do with just the languages being used and the content of music. There was stuff that, you know, even to this day, you know, kids who aren't actually from the ghetto try to emulate these things. But it's kind of the first time you start hearing all this stuff. And I guess, you know, whether it's, you know, sensationalized or not, at least, you know, some of the stuff that they, their material came from real experiences that obviously, you know, I had never ever seen before in my life.
We talked about this. Can you give us some comparisons about current division leaders, or the elites as we see them, with some current roster, you know, staples from the WWE?
Yeah, so I'm going to do 4 teams that are actually the kind of division leader teams that we haven't talked about yet. Start with the Dodgers, who I have here, I'm, in my mind, are kind of the Randy Orton of baseball right now. In that, like Orton, they have, you look at them on paper and you look at them on, like, on the field, and they just seem like the total package, like sort of engineered to win baseball games. But because of that, because of all the money they spend, and because of LA, it's just impossible to root for them. They are no one, the Dodgers, like Randy Orton, are no one's sentimental favorite and will be there, and inevitably, like, you might get excited to watch a Kershaw start, just like you might get excited for, like, I don't know, for Orton and Sheamus, but inevitably it's just going to kind of let you down. You're not going to be able to pinpoint exactly why they let you down. So yeah, the Dodgers are Randy Orton. I think if I'm going to lead with John Cena on this next one, and I think anybody listening who watches baseball and who knows the WWE at all knows that John Cena is the St. Louis Cardinals. The Cardinals have been there for so long,
they're so sanctimonious about how great they are. And their fans are just insufferable because of this "we win the right way" kind of nonsense. And as much as I kind of personally enjoy John Cena, especially he's been doing some really good work this year, the Cardinals are without a doubt the John Cena of baseball.
The Eddie Research Company, I mean, to anyone who's random, you know, you might think of the company and just, or hear the name and just think it's about a group of people hunting down Yetis or whatnot. But to me, it's about finding and researching self-fulfillment, kind of playing on the myth of the Yeti. And, you know, pretty much you're never going to find it. It's never been found. It's a mythical creature. But there's always someone who's out there going to look for it. And, you know, we kind of, you know, use that attitude and we take that to our lifestyle. You know, we search for self-fulfillment. You know, we're never satisfied. And hopefully that carries on into the business and be successful.
Sports, they're a huge part of my life, man. I don't watch a lot of TV. I don't get into these series and stuff like that. If I'm watching TV, I'm watching sports. I'm catching up on the news of sports, what's happening in the sports world. It's basically everything sports for me. So, but if I could pinpoint probably the best moment as a fan would be when the VCU Rams knocked off Kansas to make it to the Final Four. I was watching that game in the house that I currently live at. My boy Charlie Patterson. We were all sitting around watching that game. And they did it, man. VCU did it. Joey Rodriguez, Brandon Rozell, Bradford Burgess, Jamie Skeen, those guys went on that run, and they knocked off the Morris Twins to get to that Final Four. And we were so psyched, and we all kind of were standing there not knowing what to do, just kind of just being so psyched, goofy, just uncoordinated high fives, not knowing what to do. And we all looked at ourselves and just said, "Let's go to the city. Let's do it. Let's go." So we all piled in my friend Richard's car. We got in his Jeep, and we headed down to the city to join into that madness that was down there off Broad Street, man. And being living in a town, small town, Richmond, Virginia, we don't have any professional sports. I get to see, you know, in Chicago when the Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
I get to see, you know, other big market sports. When people win the pinnacle, the professional championships, you got people in the street going nuts, going crazy, having a good time. People say it's rioting. I don't say it's rioting. It's just that you're letting all that
anxiety,
that excitement, that frustration of years past that you didn't get it done, you're letting it all out. So we went down to off Broad Street and just joined in with that party down there. And it's a moment that I will never forget in my life. It was awesome. Those dudes on that team this year were just...
Quick hit question number one. Trey, who is your front runner to win the Heisman Trophy this season?
Trayvon Boykin came into this as the front runner.
TCU quarterback.
Then if you watch college football, you know who Nick Chubb is.
Running back for Georgia.
He's amazing. Great player. Just off the eye test, he's pretty tough not to pick. You could also pick three or four Ohio State players who just touch the ball, and they have a potential shot to win the Heisman.
You got
to
think JT Barrett and Ezekiel Elliott are on the top of that list.
They're outstanding players. I'm going to go with someone a little bit off the grid here, and I'm going to take Mississippi State's quarterback, Dak Prescott. He reminds me of a Logan Thomas that can actually throw the ball and complete passes.
I like that. All right.
You know, he's not going to win as many games as they did last year. The team's obviously a little down this year, but the guy puts up great stats. And I think if you can win 8 or 9 games in the SEC, you're worthy for a look at the Heisman. And, Tim Tebow did it. Johnny Manziel did it.
He won it.
Just this past weekend, they played a pretty good Southern Miss team. 2 touchdowns, threw for a lot of yards. And he also ran for 1 touchdown and rushed for 72 yards, which is a pretty solid start for him.
And this is a guy that last year showed an ability to not just put the ball in the air, but also to run the ball into the end zone, which we've seen from recent Heisman winners, whether it's Cam Newton, it's Tim Tebow. We've seen, you know, Manziel, the quarterback that can run, which is maybe Prescott's most, you know, undervalued contribution.
He is a big guy, too. I would not want to see that guy running at me on a football field.
And if you're the best player in the SEC, you know, he'll be going against Nick Chubb for that. He's got my vote. Quick hit number one. Tim, what is the best sandwich in the Richmond area?
All right, so I know I'll probably get beat up for this answer, but I had this sandwich at the Hill Cafe.
Okay.
And it's a fried green tomato sandwich with pimento cheese and bacon.
Okay. I did not expect that answer, but I like that. You know, for me, it's at the Continental. It's called the Grove Chicken Grinder. It's got baked chicken, barbecue, coleslaw, and bacon on there on ciabatta bread. It is absolutely amazing. I'm not going to badger you about the steak and cheese at the grill. I'm not going to do that to
fight,
you.
I'm never going to be able to win. So.
But can I?
I'll dispute it until the day I die.
Tim's consistency with this has made me gain a new level of respect for him. Tim, what is a good place to get a really good steak and cheese in the Richmond area?
I enjoy the Glory Days chicken cheesesteak.
So the chicken Philly.
The chicken Philly, yeah. It's just been fantastic to me. I always enjoy it. It's never dry, like the one at the grill typically can be.
Oh, I can't. I get a little side bowl of Cheese Whiz with it. I love it. But you know what? This just goes to show that Tim is consistent, and I got to go to the Hill Cafe.
Yeah.
Well, Elliot was somebody that was often linked to the Eagles, but that dramatically changed last week when the Eagles, you know, made the 5-for-2 swap, moved up from the 8th pick all the way to the 2nd pick. So 5 days later, what are some of your core thoughts on the Eagles' trade with the Browns?
Well, I can't share my core thoughts on this family-friendly show, so I'll try to taper my thoughts. I think the entire front office should resign because the decision to give up that much, how many options? Did Cleveland really have that many options to give up $1.75 on the dollar? The Eagles gave up more than the Rams gave up to move up from 15 to 1. And do you know who you're even getting? Yes, there are rumors that Jared Goff is going to go number one, but did they know that when they made this trade? Probably not, unless they have some type of mole in there. And based off of the Eagles' front office competitive intelligence, which has not been great the last few years, it's just a really boneheaded decision. And that's when you factor in the fact that you gave someone playing the exact same position $22 million guaranteed, and he obviously wants a trade, which is not surprising.
This fight, as you said, the contracts are there. It's going to happen one way or another. Are there any early thoughts that you have on this fight? It's almost impossible to do that, but this fight's too good not to take even a sneak peek at. Are you leaning either way? I know you're a huge Andre Ward guy, but Kovalev is just wrecking shop the last 2+ years.
You know, I am a little bit biased being an Andre Ward fan, and I would like to see him take a tune-up fight this summer against a big puncher to see how he handles being hit a strong, like heavyweight, maybe like an Andres Bonfara, or outside chance, Artur Beterbiev, which I don't think is going to happen. I'm hoping he doesn't take on a Gene Pascal just to show what he can do to him since Kovalev beat him for the second time in January. What's interesting about this fight is that it is a true 50-50 fight. You have a guy in Andre Ward who hasn't lost a fight since he was 12 years old. Olympic gold medalist, technically as good as anybody in the sport. And you have Kovalev, who's just a monster who comes after people and wants to hurt him. The only thing I will say that I think gives Ward the slight advantage here is that Ward has been in marquee matchups, albeit in a smaller weight classes. And also fought on the biggest stage, you know, the gold medal round of the Olympics. So the stage won't affect him. He'll be his normal self in the fight. And he is a very studious fighter. He watches a lot of tape. His coaching staff is fantastic. I think that in-ring ability and that smarts that he has that sets him apart from basically anybody in the sport right now is what gives him the edge in the fight, but a very slight edge. I would not be surprised if Kovalev won the fight. I don't think Kovalev is going to be able to knock out Andre Ward. He wasn't able to knock out Bernard Hopkins, who's a defensive wizard like Ward is. But Kovalev, like Canelo, is a much better boxer than people give him credit for. And it's going to be a highly competitive 50-50 fight. So I could see ending maybe 7-5 in favor of Andre Ward. But it can go either way.
And here it is. The number one spot, you guessed it, 1976's Rocky. Starring Sylvester Stallone, Talia Shire, Burgess Meredith, Burt Jones, and Carl Weathers,
directed by John Avildsen of the aforementioned Karate Kid. This was nominated for 10 Oscars, winning 3, including Best Director and Best Picture. Sylvester Stallone was only the third actor at that point to be nominated for writing and acting in the same year, joining Hollywood royalty in Charlie Chaplin and Orson Welles. IMDb list ranking 8.1, making it IMDb's 211th top movie of all time. Rotten Tomatoes, 93% on 56 reviews. It'd be un-American to give this a bad review. Was your number one hard to pick? Was it a toss-up between two or three movies? Was it linked to your favorite sport to play or watch as a kid? Was it a comedy, a dark drama, a mix? Whatever it may have been for you, number one was an easy pick for me. It was the story of the ultimate underdog, the ultimate story of gaining self-respect, of going against all the odds and proving to yourself, before anyone else, what you're capable of. The music, the cinematography, the massive blows that Rocky absorbs in the ring, just watching the brutality between him and Apollo Creed. Look, it's the brilliance of Apollo Creed, of Mickey, of Paulie, of Adrian. This movie's got it all, folks. Look, scoff at some of the sequels. You might go over nostalgic for the montage in the fourth movie, which is incredible, but the movie doesn't hold up as well. Or you can marvel at the transcendent promise that Creed, released in 2015, showed. Look, you can mock Thunder Lips or Mr. T or Tommy Gunn all you want. Look, put that trash aside. When it comes down to it, we all know the music and we all know the man. We all chanted his name and we know his statue, a fictional boxer, Rocky Balboa, stands at the heart of the city of Philadelphia, at the heartbeat of Philadelphia. Look, what's my favorite sports movie of all time? It's easy. Rocky. Rocky. Rocky.
Adrian! Adrian!
Rocky!
Adrian!
Rocky!
Hey,
where's
your
hat? I love you!
I love you!
I love you!
So I'm going to start off with something that you saw, I didn't, nobody else did. If you take a look at the Republican primary, how did we, and I'm going to say it, how on earth did we ultimately end up with Donald J. Trump as the presumptive Republican nominee?
I think when you look at the rest of the field, you know, obviously you see Jeb Bush coming in of the
Jeb.
16 people. Jeb. Yeah. Jeb and Dad. So, you know, obviously people are angry. They were angry at the Republican establishment for the lack of promises kept. They said, oh, we're going to come in there and we're not going to let Obamacare get passed. If you give us the House and the Senate, we're not going to let it get passed. We're going to do everything we can to repeal it. While they did do that, people said, well, they didn't do enough to try and stop it. And they basically have been a rubber stamp. I mean, Congress has the power of the purse, which means they don't have to fund anything.
The budget.
Actually, a big battle was won in court about Obamacare because I don't think there was funding in it or enough funding in it for this year. And so it's crumbling under its own weight, but it's the promises not kept by the establishment, and I don't think any outsider had the energy or was able to tap into the anger that people felt.
What is the biggest obstacle or pair of obstacles that Hillary faces in a campaign against Trump? Because in America, we cannot say it's a sure thing. What are her biggest obstacles?
I think her biggest obstacle is that she's not a good politician. I'm not a fan of Hillary Clinton in particular. I think she'll be a good governor of the, you know, and she will execute the laws competently. But she's just not a good politician. You know, this email thing has been a disaster, largely of her own making.
Yes, she has literally ignored it or pushed it to the side, and it doesn't work that way.
Or made fun of it.
Done that terrible idea.
And then, you know, another thing I would point to is all she has to do, and this is not a small thing, all she has to do to win this election is get out the 2012 Obama coalition.
Mm-hmm.
Because if she gets out the 2012 Obama coalition, Republicans can't win. We could be talking about Jeb Bush right now. Republicans cannot win. The electoral map is so bad for them that if the 2012 Democrats come out to vote, they win. So all she should be doing from here until November is getting out the vote of the Obama coalition. And what do we see articles about in the news? About how she's going to pivot to the center and right to try to win over disaffected Republicans.
That's not going to work.
Well, that's not going to work for two reasons. One, we're a more polarized country than we've ever been. But two, moderate or independents and Republicans hate Clinton. They've spent 20 years hating Clinton. She's not going to win those votes. The best she can hope is that those people don't vote. They stay home because they don't want to vote for Trump. But you don't have to do anything to get them to not come out, right? You just keep playing your game.
Absolutely.
And so she's just a bad politician. She gets in her own way.
And of course, number one, and it really wasn't close for me, The Two Escobars, episode 16 of volume 1. The lives of soccer player Andres Escobar and drug lord Pablo Escobar. The intertwining of crime and soccer in their native Colombia, and the connections between the murders of both men. Simply put, this Academy Award level documentary is filmmaking at its best right here. It's the absolute best 30 for 30 has delivered, and I couldn't ask for anything better in the future if I'm being honest. You don't have to be a fan of Narcos or know the story in advance of either Escobar to become almost instantly entranced. It's a story of heartbreak, despair, and the power of evil. The Two Escobars is what ESPN's 30 for 30 does best. It grabs your attention and refuses to let it go. It intertwines drama with sports in a real-life story you have to know the end to. It's the best 2 hours ESPN has given us in years from any medium. And for that, I say to 30 for 30 and ESPN, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Surprising to me, why do you think Klay Thompson doesn't get more pub? I think if you're a basketball fan, you know who Klay Thompson is. I mean, his father, Michael Thompson, his brother's a star on the Dodgers. What does Klay Thompson have to do to become one of those names? Because this is a second team All-NBA guy that arguably is a top 6 or 7 player in the league.
I believe it's the Curry vacuum because he does all these things. He hits all these shots and does all these spectacular things that I think the basic things that Klay Thompson does on the court kind of get overshadowed because of what Steph Curry does. Because he knows he's a closer. And a lot of people remember the closers. When it's 5 minutes left and it's winning time, we're looking at Steph Curry. We're not looking at Klay Thompson.
No, you're exactly right. You know, if we go to a basketball perspective, being that you've played the game your entire life, you know, most commentators agree that Klay Thompson has one of the quickest releases in terms of his shot, maybe in NBA history. That sounds obvious, but let's go a little deeper. You're guarding somebody who's noted for a release and for size like Klay Thompson. What's your biggest fear, or what's your number one game plan if you have to defend somebody like that?
As far as Klay Thompson, I don't think one person is going to be able to guard him. I think it's going to have to be a team effort to guard him. If I had to guard him, the one thing I'm going to make him do is I'm going to make him drive to the basket. He's not putting up my bucket threes on me. I'd rather for a 2 than a 3. As soon as he has that quick of a release, I'm putting my whole body up against him, and I'm making him drive. If he beats me driving, cool. But he's not going to just start lighting up threes because he can turn and get hot really quick.
Wait a second. A man has the right to change his name to whatever he wants to change it to. And if a man wants to be called Muhammad Ali, this is a free country, you should respect his wishes and call the man Muhammad Ali.
His mama named him Klay. I'm going to call him Klay.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I say Klay.
What is it about a show called Mr. Robot on USA that has you hooked?
Things. I mean, I think the first thing is the main character, Elliot. You know, here's a guy who's got social anxiety disorder and substance abuse issues and things like that. And what's cool about the show is they do a voiceover, a narration from the main character, Elliot's perspective. I was thinking about it. If it was the other way around and we were kind of like on the outside looking in, I don't think he'd be as interesting of a character. He definitely wouldn't be likable at all. But because we can kind of see the world through his point of view, it just makes things a lot more interesting. So the main character and his kind of his battle with things and his delusions are really interesting to me. And another thing is like the heavy Stanley Kubrick influence, I guess, in the
show. I mean, everything from the cinematography to score and sound effects and just overall production. You know, I think it's really cool. You know, you can definitely pick up on a lot of influences from a lot of great movies, but Stanley Kubrick's like really stands out to me, and I think that's pretty cool.
I'm glad you bring up the Kubrick thing, and I never thought of it that way. You know, I sort of channel a little bit of David Fincher in him. It's got a little bit of a Fight Club, Social Network type feel to it. But I think Fincher is just the modern-day Kubrick in the sense that dark tones, dark camera filters, dark music, you know, that sort of Trent Reznor type sound that we know now in movies is pretty cool. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, it's a good call.
Deadpool lived up to every great review it got. Between that and Guardians of the Galaxy, those are about the only two comic movies I've still been able to get through and really enjoy. So this is a little bit of a departure from my normal interests.
Well, you're one episode into Preacher. Is this a show that you're going to continue to watch? Are you going to give it one more episode? Or do you feel that you're invested and it's going to jump into your regular viewing lineup for this summer?
I think it's definitely going to jump into the regular viewing. Where we stand after the first season waits to be seen. We're a little cautious so far on being fully committed, but I think it's got enough good things there to definitely keep you coming back for the first season. See where it goes, how it plays out. Got good, strong characters, people you can quickly like, quickly identify with, and it's... I don't know exactly where the plot's going, but I am curious to see. My only worry, my biggest worry, actually, is that campiness, the supernatural, takes a turn for the worst. And by that, I mean True Blood after the first season or two, when it kind of went off the rails. That's my worry. I don't know if it's going to do that. I think it's grittier, but I am worried.
What got you interested in FX's The Americans, especially since it's in its fourth season right now?
I don't know why now, right? Because it's been around and it's been critically acclaimed for a while, and I've known that for a while, right? I was aware of the show. But I think I just had a moment where I was like, you know, maybe I should check it out.
Yeah.
And it was just like a random moment. And then, of course, because of Amazon and Netflix and all these things, you can just go check it out. And it's a show that's totally suited for who I am as a human being. It hits all of my erogenous zones.
It's one of those shows where I'm always like, there are shows that I regret not watching. I regret not watching Sons of Anarchy when it was on. Yeah. I regret not watching The Americans now, and I need to rectify that.
It's Hayward pulling it down, getting around Zubat. At midcourt, launches the shot. Oh, it almost went in! Almost went in, and Duke is the king of the dance, 2010.
What if I told you that one shot almost changed sports? Proposal number 9, the butler... almost did it. In 2010, Butler was more than just a Cinderella. They were one half-court shot away from a national championship. Gordon Hayward's lob just missing the bank. It also just missed becoming a seminal moment in college basketball and sports history. Perhaps the single greatest moment in college basketball or sports ever. What would that shot have meant if it went in? We'll never truly know.
Is there a bust that you think a lot of people won't see coming this week they should avoid?
Yeah, you can pick out a lot of names, especially coming into this course because it's going to expose some people. But the one that stuck out in my mind is Henrik Stenson. That's one of Crumrine's picks, so shocker there. But he's just coming in horrible form. He hasn't finished top 10 in a major since the 2014 PGA Championship. He's missed the cut in his last two PGA starts. And you don't ever want to come into a big event with not a lot of confidence. You don't want to come into anything without a lot of confidence, let alone a major at U.S. Open, at Oakmont. So, and he just, his putter, man, I don't have any confidence in his putter. He's, where is it at? He's 151st strokes gained putting on the PGA Tour. Ooh. He's coming in at 25-1 odds. I just don't see it happen for the Swede or Tim Crumrine, for that matter, at all.
Well, your third pick is the first real controversial pick because he's Jimmy's bust of the week. He's somebody that I've given up on because he's burned me in too many of my pools. Henrik Stenson, the Swede. Why'd you take Stenson, a guy that it seems like he's got Sergio-itis? He's not going to win the big one.
It was funny because I thought about a couple different guys. I also went in a little bit of a panic, but I wanted either Matsuyama or Rose. And I think Johnson got both of those guys with his double pick at the top of the stake, coming back my way. So I was hoping for those two, and then after they were gone, I just had to put my thinking cap on. I'm not thrilled about picking Stenson, to be honest, but I mean, he is always up on the leaderboard. Well, traditionally up on the leaderboard, maybe not at Augusta anymore, but he's still got a hell of a good game. I mean, he can't putt, and that's probably not good for Gibbs Open, but he might catch a little bit of something this week, and I don't know. If you can strike the ball down the middle and you can hit acceptable iron shots, which he can hit the ball sky high, to greens at Oakmont that are going to be fast as lightning, and they also have a ton of undulation. If you can get to the right parts of the greens, you can make birdies, so you gotta make a putt, but you gotta be able to hit the shots to give yourself a chance. And he can hit the shots. I don't know if he can finish it off, but he can hit the shots.
So you think that Stenson's ability just to be a shot maker might be enough to let him contend this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, you gotta hit the fairways, you gotta be able to hit the ball high, which he can do. A lot of guys can do, but he definitely is one of them.
What? I gotta go PPS now. I mean, one of the biggest debates that Tim and Jimmy had, Henrik Stenson. What do you see for the Swede?
He doesn't have the short game to get it done. He's definitely got the iron accuracy in the distance, especially off the tee, but, you know, he relies a little too heavily on his three wood. Once he has to get that driver out the bag, and make a couple putts, you know, it's gonna be all downhill for the Swede. I could see him struggling to make the cut out here, to be honest.
You know, one of the big stories that came out of last night's UFC 199 was that media members, a lot of them, were escorted out of the event for breaking this story. What do you make of that?
Yeah, the biggest name is Ariel Helwani, who's probably one of the most reputable MMA columnists in the industry. He used to work for Fox Sports 1. He now works full-time for MMAfighting.com. Has a weekly show where he has top-level guys on the show every week. Basically, my understanding is that the UFC wanted to be the ones who announced Brock Lesnar was returning, as they did in that UFC 200 spot that aired during UFC 199 last night. And Ariel Helwani receives information. His job, and what he gets paid to do, is to inform the public. He's not employed by the UFC. He's employed by MMAfighting.com. He received the news. It was credible enough for him to report it, and he did. And it ended up he was right. But the UFC, because they wanted to be the ones who did it, said, all right, we're yanking your credentials, you're out of here, and you're banned for life, according to him. But, you know, that's part of the problem. The UFC doesn't really realize that these media outlets do not work for them, but they want these people to be their puppets, and if you're not going to be their puppet, they'll escort you out of the building, like they did last night.
So it sounds like you like the blueprint that the Braves have, and you like the 3 to 4 year projection of their future. Where do you hope to see the Atlanta Braves 2, 3, 4 seasons down the road when those single A and double A prospects are now on the major league roster full time?
I mean, I think the future is very, very, very bright. If you look at sort of the model the Braves are taking, it follows very closely that of the Astros. And you look, and that was a team that traded off not just like veteran major league talent, but a little bit of young major league talent to sort of make sure that their guys were going to be coming into the league and maturing at about the right time, about the same time. And for the Braves, I look also around the rest of the division, and if our window for contention is here in the next 2 to 3 years, very optimistically, 3 to 4 years, I think makes a lot of sense. The rest of the division has some question marks at that point. The Nats have a lot of contracts that look great now for guys like Scherzer that are going to look, I think, really bad within 3 to 4 years. And you kind of wonder what they're going to be able to do with Strasburg and with Harper. So the team that I hate the most is weirdly probably one of the teams I'm the least worried about in the division. I think Philly looks good going forward, but still kind of lacks the quality of young arms in the Myers and Braves have. Marlins are the Marlins. And the Mets, so they've got all that great young pitching. You got to wonder, 3 to 4 years, and that some of those guys start hitting free agency, if the Wilpons and ownership of the Mets are going to be able to have the money to keep them around. So I think the future is really bright. We've got some great young pitchers. A guy named Sean Newcomb, who we got from the Angels, Randall Simmons, Tuki Toussaint, who is going to be one of the greatest names in the game the minute he hits the major leagues. So we basically just kind of stole from the Diamondbacks. We had to agree to take Bronson Arroyo's dead money, and they threw him in. And I think he's pretty electric. So I feel really good. I think we're setting up to have a team that can
look like the Astros do now, and or the that the Royals do now, 3 or 4 years down the road. I feel good.
Oh, coast is clear.
I told you, she's a 7-Eleven, pounding nachos.
Hold up there, Duke boys.
Hey, we need to talk to Quinn. Someone took all the vending machines out of the building. This is a civil rights emergency.
Oh, well, let me get Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the phone.
He's dead, Tammy. We need to see Quinn.
He can't help you. No one can. It's those bitches in the PTA. I'd rather put on a thong and dance naked in a pit of cobras before I cross that coven.
What a super unappetizing
Why would you put on a thong first? That makes no sense.
Get out.
Listen. If I don't get my sugar, if these kids don't get their sugar fix, this whole place is going to turn into a goddamn zoo.
A goddamn zoo.
Oh, they're going to get their fix, all right. Don't worry about that. Whenever there's a voice, someone fills it.
Huh. You know what, Tammy? I think you just gave me a good idea. You're really earning that $17.5 a year, aren't you?
Oh, you should have let it hit you.
Oh, God. Now, you are quicker than you look, Tammy. Stop.
Last up, let's go to another channel that a lot of you don't know about. True TV. Those Who Can't on True TV had its season finale on April 14th. It's nearly impossible to make a good show about teachers. Speaking as a teacher, I've always been hopeful when a new project is announced based on the subject. Early 2000s, three-year wonder, and then dud, Boston Public. Look, it tried to make every episode feel like a season finale, and all you saw was a school with far too many controversies and cover-ups to truly exist. It's hard in the real world. And Mr. Robinson on NBC, starring Craig Robinson of The Office, Hot Tub Time Machine, it was just a dreck. Ditto for NBC's short-lived Teachers, which aired around 2009-2010, starring Justin Bartha of The Hangover. So here comes the first original series from True TV, yes, that True TV, with things like Lizard Lick Towing and tons of March Madness games in the first two weekends. And it stars a cast of relative unknowns. And you know what? The show is raunchy as hell, and it's absolutely hilarious. Getting renewed for a second season 3 months before a show is even aired, True TV knew they had a winner, and they were spot on. Again, it's raunchy, it's vulgar, and you don't have to be a teacher to see the merit and enjoy the filth on the show. It's the things we all wish we could say or do sometimes as people of authority. It's things that we wish we might have done as students or could have had done to students, no matter where we work. No matter what your feelings are towards education, that's not important for this show. Sometimes dirty humor can be smart. Think of The Hangover. Think of Mel Brooks' extensive library. Think of Caddyshack. Think of movies like Half-Baked, Happy Gilmore, Billy Madison, those 90 movies that you just love to laugh at. This is a show, Those Who Can't, in which the actors are comfortable in their roles. It's not star-studded, it's not an over-bloated ensemble cast with more egos than substance. Getting people to turn to True TV, it's not always easy, I never did it. But that shouldn't be the case with Those Who Can't. A story of three teachers in a school filled with degenerates, delinquents, and frankly, douchebags, in one of the lowest performing schools in Colorado. Those Who Can't is easily one of the funniest dirty shows on television. And that means everyone, not just teachers, can absolutely enjoy Those Who Can't. On a quick side note, I'd like to thank once again Ben Roy, a.k.a. Billy Shoemaker of Those Who Can't on True TV. If you didn't catch it, a season 3, episode 3, I did my spring TV pop culture corner. Talked about some big shows on the spring lineup right now, and one of them was my new favorite show, especially from the comedy scene, Those Who Can't. About teachers in suburban Colorado, just debauchery, you know, a crude humor that a lot of people can enjoy. And Ben listened to the show. It's huge. The guy is insanely talented. I follow him on Twitter now. I've actually checked out his band, his rock and roll band Spells. It's great, actually. It's just fun music. I'm not sure if it's as cool as Capitalist Emulsification, his, pseudo band on the show. But again, I cannot recommend it enough. Those Who Can't on True TV, I've never heard anybody say a negative word about it, teacher or not. Ben Roy is hilarious. Billy Shoemaker is a great character on the show. And it's awesome when you get feedback like this. This is a podcast that reaches a couple hundred people every week, but we hope to help it grow. And I'm going to reach out to Ben and see if we can get him on the show once season 2 is about to premiere of Those Who Can't, so we can talk about this great show hitting its second season. And we can talk about his band and maybe talk a little bit of sports, see what he's interested in. But again, shout out to Ben Roy. Very cool of him to reach out to us.
And as always, we appreciate all of our fans, all the support we get, because without them, well, there's no reason to be here. Well, speaking of somebody with untapped potential, a guy that put up an all-pro type season a few years ago, why do you and so many Browns fans seem to have unlimited hope for a guy like wide receiver Josh Gordon as opposed to Manziel?
Let me pose a question to you, River City Clement.
All right.
Name an exciting offensive player for the Browns since 1999.
I mean, I can't. I think Dennis Northcutt had a good four-game stretch, but you're right. Josh Gordon was as dynamic as it got.
Yeah, I mean, he's really the only player we've had since 1999 that, character issues aside, other teams would actually covet. They would actually like to have him on the roster, completely disregarding all the other, you know, off-the-field stuff. But looking at my thorough notes here, he led the league in receiving in 14 games, and he was catching balls from Brandon Weeden and Jason Campbell.
Wow.
So just overcoming that obstacle shows you what an athletic freak this guy is. So just the fact that he's an exciting player, and, you know, maybe he's a departure from the run, pass, punt offense that we've seen for the last 16 years. Just the fact that he is enticing to other teams. We haven't had a player like that really since we came back in the league. So I found an amazing stat on the Browns last night. In the 16 years since they came back into the NFL, they have signed 12 players to a second contract.
Wow.
Pretty much everybody does their rookie contract, either gets cut, arrested, or they just bail as soon as they possibly can.
What's the one piece of advice that you would want to give Hillary Clinton and her team for the next 6 weeks before we get to Philadelphia?
Follow Obama. I think people underestimate Obama's ability to play the long game politically. He's been doing it, and we've been constantly underestimating him. He did it in both campaigns. In 08, he did it by beating Clinton through caucuses and organization. In 12, he did it by successfully kind of defining Mitt Romney over the stretch of 8 months as a plutocrat. He did it with healthcare. He's done it with his executive order strategy. I mean, he just plays the long game really well. And I think Clinton needs to do that both to beat Trump by defining him, and she's doing that already, but also by bringing the Bernie Sanders people in. You play the long game. Don't try to force them early on because that's going to cause the backlash. Slowly woo them. Let them have their protests. Let them get out their emotions. And then slowly do what you need to do to bring them into the party.
Sorry, Tayshaun Prince, you're now the silver medal in Kupferheim blocks in NBA history. During the closing 2 minutes of this game, I was shaking. I was texting furiously with friends. My stomach was in my throat. And Cleveland isn't my team. I just wanted this for them. I wanted this for LeBron. Even sports couldn't be this cruel, not this time. And when the final buzzer sounded, Cleveland became Believeland. All hail King James. All hail Cleveland. All hail the 2016 NBA champions.
Tim Crumride, you are back on the show. You're ready for the Grand Slam Challenge. And guess who's in the studio? Old Jimbo Wright.
The Mac is here, baby. Boy.
Tim, I know that you're excited because it's not just me you're dealing with. It is your actual nemesis. I think you and I are beer pong nemesis, but this is real.
This is very real. That's why we got a little extra dough on the line, too.
That's right. So Tim is actually got a side bet with Jimmy. And this is awesome radio. The missus is walking in the door. She's ready to go. So we got Tim on the line. Heather's in the house. Jimmy's here. Tim, we're going to... Hey, there we go.
Touche. Good stuff. The cat eating the food distracted me right there. I'm allergic to cats.
Our cat loves Jimmy, first off. But my cat gets so nervous every time that I talk out loud that she's a nervous eater. So she literally starts eating. So here's the great thing. Next time Jimmy comes on... That's going to be the previously on clip with the cat eating. So shout out to Bo, our cat. Shout out to Jimmy. Shout out to you, the listeners.
Now, do you enjoy the Netflix model, being able to binge watch a show as quickly as you want? Or do you like the standard once a week?
Who doesn't love to be able to binge watch? I mean, it absolutely makes for a lazy day, but it's really nice to know that you can, you know, turn on a show and be able to kind of watch it all in one, you know, at one time instead of having to stop and wait for the next week. So I enjoy it.
Well, I know that we watched 3 episodes on Friday night, so I was a little Netflix and chill. Do you have a favorite character on the show?
I don't think I do. I think all of the characters sort of come together in their own unique ways.
No, I agree. I mean, it's an ensemble comedy, and I think what makes the show so unique
is it doesn't lean on just Piper or Alex or one or two characters. Even, you know, Suzanne Crazy Eyes, it's not just her show. Mm-hmm. And you can often not see a character for two or three episodes, and you don't even miss them. Now, you've seen the first three episodes of season four. What were your thoughts?
Still, I mean, it's still a great show. I thought it came in really strong with introducing some crazy new conflict, which is kind of their what they're known for. Also kind of started to... And that's Bo.
Shout out to the cat. That's 2 weeks in a row. We're keeping that.
To how they sort of show you the different race dynamics that are within the prison. That's a big element to the show that I think kind of is sort of one of their underlying plots behind everything. But it's sort of, I don't know, relevant in today's culture. It's sort of a parallel to what's happening in today's society.
I agree completely. I know we'll probably watch an episode or two tonight. But that's the cool thing is that you can binge watch it. You're kind of depressed when the season's over. But I think that this is the type of show where, and you said this the other night, they keep you wanting more, mm-hmm. and it would be torture to wait a week.
Mm-hmm.
And there it is, the very best we had to offer from seasons 2 and 3 here at the Baker's Dozen Podcast. Don't worry, as we aren't going anywhere this summer, except continuing to deliver to you the best sports, pop culture, and political content we possibly can. Will season 4 start next week? No. Will we post weekly episodes every week this summer? No. Will we go cold for the summer? Absolutely not. While the schedule may be a little more sporadic, we'll still be here with plenty of special edition episodes, quick hit episodes, and a few other surprises. And I'll still continue to have guests on, and we'll still continue to tackle the major issues of that week, month, or this summer season. Trust me, we're not coasting this summer. We're not on vacation. Not by a long shot. Season 4 will kick off either later this summer or early fall, but we'll never be far away. We'll also still have several episodes to go in our limited series, Rise to the Challenge, in which we have reviewed every episode thus far of MTV's The Challenge, Rivals 3. Those will drop every Friday until the series finale in mid-July. Who knows, maybe another limited series won't be far behind either. We hope to keep you guessing here. The best way to keep up with the Baker's Dozen podcast this summer is subscribe to the show, whether on iTunes, the podcast app, or just bookmarking our page at Podomatic.com, and interacting with us on social media. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, it's the best way to always be updated. That way, any and all new episodes are automatically downloaded to your phone, tablet, or streaming device. And you can interact with us and maybe suggest things that you want to hear talk about, or come on the show yourself and talk to us. Whether it's on the phone line or in the studio, it's really that simple. Subscribing to the show also allows you to check out our extensive archive. Whether it's a US Open preview or NBA Finals recap that you may have already heard, there are still plenty of stories that have gone by that you shouldn't be silent on. Why not check out some of our pop culture or political offerings? Episode 10 of Season 3, which dropped 2 weeks ago, previewed 10 summer TV shows to check out and can help you on a rainy day or lazy Sunday this summer. Either way, we hope you'll continue to spread the word, and we'll be sure to let you know as soon as we have a release date for Season 4, which will be another 13-episode commitment that I've already started planning. One last time, thank you for your support the past 3 seasons, especially this most recent one when we got things back on track, thanks to my truckload of guests and honestly friends who never bat an eye and are always willing to come on this show, often after a long day of work, whether on the phone or in the studio. I can't bug them too much for them not to help me. It's a privilege I'm honestly not worthy of, but I appreciate it each and every day. Trust me on that. This show is at its absolute best when we have our tremendous guests either on the phone or in the studio. They bring this show alive. Nobody is more important to this show's success. The microphone I'm using, air I'm breathing, it's all because of Heather Grubb. She's my life. She's my life force. She's not on this show enough, but trust me, I am eternally grateful for what she does for me and for my ability to bring you this podcast. Season 4 is closer than you think, folks, and I'm also looking forward to reflecting on some of the successes and some of the shortcomings of the past season and finding each and every way to improve this show. I need feedback. Positive feedback is awesome, but you learn better from constructive or even negative criticism. It's the great challenge of a podcast, and the reason I'm still doing this is because I'm still learning. I'm getting better, but I got a long way to go, and I'm still having way too much fun. And Season 4... I guarantee it continues that trend, I promise. My name's River City Clement, and by now, you know how it goes. It's on to the next one. 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 On to the next one.
But I'm going to start out with another big name, man. And I'm not sure. We good over there?
Yeah, good podcast moment. We're going to keep that.
We're rolling.
It's live.